I really don't claim to be a guru on the topic of SNEWD. I haven't spent my life researching sources and looking into it. I haven't even spent all my life practicing it, to be honest with you. That was something that changed at some point in my life. And I was, you know, whether fortunately or unfortunately, just kind of depending on your own perspective, I never really had the opportunity to learn the sources inside. I started practicing SNEWD well before I really knew why. I just knew that I should, so I did. And I never really saw the sources inside. And I think that now, having seen the sources inside, having been forced to, because I taught a class on it, I'm teaching a class on it, and I taught a class in it last semester and now this semester in Ida Crown to junior girls. So you can imagine, I mean, as difficult as this crowd is, that's a pretty difficult crowd. A bunch of hormonal 16-year-olds, lots of fun. It was actually a very, very nice group. It was a small group, and it was a nice group. It is not the first thing I teach, so by the time we get there, there's already a rapport, and it's really nice. Again, you know, some of you I recognize, and some of your faces I don't, and I think a lot of this does require some semblance of, I don't know, relationship with the speaker, because it's such a sensitive and personal topic. And so I'm going to apologize about that also at the get-go, that, you know, you may leave here with questions that I haven't answered, and you may disagree with some of the things that I'm going to present or say, and you may have questions, and, you know, I'm happy to address as much as I can during this year. There may not be enough time to address everything. I did come in a little late, but, you know, I just hope that it sparks some thought, and that it sparks some meaning, and that it sparks, you know, something to think about and hopefully help us, you know, maybe apply something small to our daily lives. So it is a two-part series. This is part one. Part two will be next week at the home of Rebecca Amster in West Rogers Park. I don't know her address by heart. I apologize, but I'm sure you guys know where she lives. And anyway, so that's going to be halacha. This week, we're going to really focus on, like I said, in the title is called "It's Not All in What We Wear." I love the quote I found on the front, especially being from the fashion designer that it's from. Right, over the years, I've learned that what is important in a dress is the woman who is wearing it. And that's kind of the theme that I'd like to address tonight. And the way that I would like to begin is actually asking you a question. What does the word tzniut mean?
Modesty.
Modesty, right? That is the classic catch-all translation of the word tzniut. And yes, colloquially today, that is how we refer to the concept of tzniut. But what does it really mean? What does it mean in Judaism? What does it mean in halacha? What does it mean in its original text when it appears in Tanakh? And I think that if we go back to the roots of the word tzniut, if we go back to the original sources of the word tzniut, we will find that it does not necessarily mean the catch-all word modesty. I think it has to do with modesty. I don't think that it's a bad translation. I just think it's a very limiting translation. And it's a kind of, I don't know, I think it's hard to put our finger on what exactly does modesty even mean. I think that it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And we're kind of going to see that today. If we look in Tanakh, we find the Shoresh of Tzniut, Sadi Nun Ayin, appears twice, only twice, which is a little bit crazy if you think about the amount of words in Tanakh. There are a few times where we find some Shoreshim that really don't appear more than once, or in Tanakh, you know, very few times. So we're lucky, at least the Shoresh of Sadi Nun Ayin does appear twice. And the first time it appears, if you turn your source sheets over to page 2, is in Sefer Micha. Micha was a Navi. His Sefer is included in the Treyasar because it's a short Sefer and Chazal didn't want it to get lost. So they kind of lumped him together with 11 other Nevi'im who also had short Sfarim so that the scroll would be long enough so that it wouldn't get lost in the shuffle. Otherwise, I mean, you can say that they're related to each other, but really they're all over the chronology and the history and the themes. And, it was really a practical consideration. Anyway, in Sefer Micha, Perek Vav, Pasuk Chet, we're given a pasuk that does have the shorish of Sadi Nun Ayin, which I think is a somewhat well-known pasuk. If you turn to source number 1, Higid lecha adam ma tov, uma Hashem doresh mimcha. Right, man will tell you what is good and what Hashem wants from you. Ki imasot mishpat. Right, what does Hashem want from you? Now the pasuk is going to delineate three different things that Hashem wants of us. The first is asot mishpat, to do justice. Right, to act justly with our fellow man, the ahavat chesed, and to love loving kindness, as we usually translate it into English, one of those, again, catch-all phrases, what does that really mean? But in general, asot mishpat v'ahavat chesed, generally together, tzedek u'mishpat, refers to the idea of social justice, as is usually translated today, the idea of binagam mahabiro, of behaving nicely with our fellow man. But then the third thing is itemized, and the pasuk continues, what's the third requirement that Hashem wants of us? V'hatzneya lecha im elokecha. We should walk with God b'tzniut. But what does that mean? Right, we're told that, okay, beinadam l'chaviro, do justice, you know, love chesed. But when it comes to Hashem, walk with him b'tzniut. But what does it mean to walk with Hashem b'tzniut? And this is where we're going to see a lot of sources that are somewhat similar and somewhat different in terms of how the Rishonim really grappled with the idea of what does tzniut really mean. So the Mitzudat Tzion, that was written by, I think, Rabbi Altshuler, don't quote me on that. But it was kind of like a dictionary. You might have heard of Mitzudat David and Mitzudat Tzion. Mitzudat David was more of his Pirush's commentary. Mitzudat Tzion was his dictionary for hard words that are seldomly found in Tanakh. And if you turn to source number 2, he translates what Hatzneya means. Milashon Tzniot, okay, we knew that. V'hester. What does tzniut actually mean? It means hidden, right? Not so bad that we're in the weeks leading up to Purim that we're, you know, in at least one of the Adars. Because tzniut really means hidden. Right? We can connect that to modesty a little bit. We see where modesty came from. But if we move on, you know, I think that the question becomes, what does it mean hidden? What does it mean in context? What does it mean to walk hidden with Hashem? That we have to go hide out when we daven? We can't show anyone that we're doing mitzvot? Like, what does it mean to be hidden when it comes to walking with Hashem? And here we're actually going to see a number of sources that I said, like I said before, they're somewhat similar but somewhat divergent. In source number 3, the Mitzudat David, same rabbi, different area in which he expounded upon what he meant, he explains, Ritzonolomar, in shem davar ki im, right? What is this pasuk coming to teach us? That there's nothing we should do except for la'asot mishpat, to do justice, la'ehova tatzedek, to love righteousness, v'lalecha im elokecha b'darchei mitzvotav, and to follow Hashem in the ways of his mitzvot, b'tzina v'lo b'pirsum. Lo b'pirsum rav u'lehit yaher. That we should act b'tzina, now we know he already translates that in a hidden kind of way, and not too flashy, right? Not with this great publicity, u'lehit yaher, that comes from the word yuhara, which means arrogance. That we should go about serving God with humility, with, you know, a little bit of privacy. We shouldn't go shouting out to everyone, look what I'm doing, I'm sitting in the sukkah. Look what I'm doing, I'm davening, and look how much kavana I have. Right, we should be doing the mitzvot in a more private kind of way. And by the way, just so you know, this pasuk is not only aimed toward women. This is aimed toward everybody. Men and women have the commandment of Hatznei Alachad Im Alokacha, that we have to walk with Hashem B'tzniot. And so we all, men, women, we have to do things in a more private kind of way, according to the Mitzvah David, in a more hidden kind of way, and not go, you know, flaunting our Avodah Hashem to everyone else in the world. The Ibn Ezra has a slightly different way of looking at it in source number 4. He explains that Sneya Lechtecha in Hashem Livado, we shall walk, Bitzniyot, whatever that means, he explains in a moment, with Hashem himself. Shateilech bidrachav bitam levav, meaning we should follow his ways with a pure heart, hefech kshi oref, the opposite of stubbornness. So this is a little bit different. The Ibn Ezra here is saying that tzniut means the opposite of stubbornness. Right? What's the opposite of stubbornness? What word would you put as the opposite of stubbornness?
Acquiescence.
Okay, acquiescence. Anything else?
Humility.
Mm-hmm. Humility. Anything else? Open-mindedness. Sorry, what did you say?
Grace.
Okay, so I think that these can all fit. Right? The Ibn Ezra is telling us that when we do our Avodat Hashem, we shouldn't do it with this stubborn approach of, but I don't want to do that, and my will, you know, trumps yours. No, we should do the opposite. Hashem, your will trumps mine. I'm open to whatever you have to say. I'm going to serve you and do whatever you say because that's what I have to do. I'm not going to be stubborn about it. I'm not going to claim that, you know, my will comes before yours. The Radak in source number 5, I'm sorry, it is a bunch of sources, but I think it is important just to get us a well-rounded understanding of what tzniut means. The Radak in source number 5 adds a dimension that we haven't even seen before. And he says, this is believing in the oneness of God and loving him. B'chol levavo, with all of our hearts, with all our souls. He basically is quoting Shema and the Ahavta right here. right? This is Yichud Hashem and Avad Hashem are the first two psukim in Kriyat Shema. The Amar veHatzneya. So what does this have to do with Tzniut, Avad Hashem, and belief in one God, loving Hashem? What's going on? The Amar Hatzneya ki Hadavar Hazem Masur Lelev. Because belief in one God and loving God, they are related to our hearts. They're transmitted to our hearts. They're a mitzvah that we do from our heart. And that is something that's tsanua. Because our heart is hidden, right? Some of us wear our hearts on our sleeves. That's true. It's a personality thing. But, you know, even when that's the case, no one really knows what's going on in our hearts. If we're believing in Hashem and we're loving Him, does anyone really, really know? Right? We can pretend really, really well. Either way, right? No one really knows what's going on inside. And so the Radak is saying that means that even in your heart of hearts, even on the inside of who you are, you should be actively loving Hashem and believing in Him and who He is. Really, and His oneness. And I want you guys to keep this in mind. The reason why I asked for the markers is because I wanted to kind of write down a list of everything so far. So let's just, you know, sum up for a moment. The Mitzudat Zion told us that it means hidden. I'm going to put this up in a minute, okay? Hiddenness. Once I got a whole rainbow full, I'll just use them all to make it pretty, okay? The Mitzudat David tells us that we should worship Hashem with humility, the opposite of arrogance, which is usually humility. The Ibn Ezra says that we should worship Hashem with, I'm going to call it open-mindedness, the opposite of stubbornness. But meaning being open-minded to what Hashem has to say and not claiming that our will trumps His. And then the Radak says that it's talking about faith and love. Okay, so that's it so far. I'll just add as we go because I think, you know, it's important to have it. There are so many sources. I want to see it all on one list. The Al-Sheikhin source number 6 again adds another dimension. And he says, "V'al-hanogeya bein adam l'makom amar v'hatznaya lachet nimalokecha." As we said, the pasuk is divided between bein adam l'chaviro, between man and his friend, and bein adam l'makom, between man and God. And the pasuk tells us that we have to walk b'tzniut. Shelo bilvad ta'avod et Hashem bechol lev b'makom ro'im. That we shouldn't only worship Hashem whenever in a place that everyone sees. Ki im gam b'makom she'ein ro'im. But we should also worship Hashem in the private recesses of our own home, in places that no one sees us. V'hu ma'am aram zechornam levracha she'geder chasid hu mi she'beseter yimana me'asot. And this is what Chazal meant when they said that who's a chasid? Who is someone who, and this is before the Hasidish movement, okay, so they're talking about all Jews, but who is a, you know, pious man, someone who doesn't do something wrong even when they're in private. Something that he wouldn't do in public. So when you act the same, whether you're in private or whether you're in public, that is considered walking with Hashem b'tzniut. And that's why it says that we should walk b'tzniut. Meaning when you're only with Hashem, in other words, Hashem is the only one who can see you because you're in private and no one else can see you, you're still doing the right thing. And you're not doing, you know, you don't act one way in public and one way in private. When you are only with Hashem, when you are private and hidden and no one else sees you, you should act the same way when it's only Hashem seeing you as you would when everyone else is seeing you. So I think I like to call this consistency, right? Consistency when we're in private as well. Okay. Those are the mefarshim that I found interesting on the first pasuk in which the shorish of tzniut appears, and that is in Sefer Micha. The second time that the shorish of tzniut appears, as Sadi Nun Ayin, actually appears in Sefer Mishle. If you turn to source number 7, Sefer Mishle, Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Bet, Shlomo tells us, Bazadon viavo kalon. He tells us that when an intentional sinner comes, like when you do something bemazed, that's considered to be when someone sins intentionally. When an intentional sinner comes, viavo kalon, then disgrace also comes. Right, disgrace follows an intentional sinner. Ve'et snuim chachma. So it's a little hard to translate, but Rashi helps us. He says ve'et snuim chachma means tavo chachma, and when snuim come, then chachma will follow. So in this pasuk, we are given a slightly additional insight into tzniut. It seems that someone who acts b'tzniut is considered to be the opposite of a zadon, of an intentional sinner. Someone who acts with tzniut is obviously considered to be someone positive, versus a zadon who's obviously someone negative. But what does that mean, that chachma will follow someone who acts with tzniut? So here we have three different opinions. The Mitzvah Tzion follows himself, thank God, he's very consistent. And in source number 9, he explains, tznuim are hamista trim atzman, merov anvitanutam. We're talking about those who hide themselves because they're so humble. So we got hiddenness and humility already. I'm not going to add that to the list. But again, you know, he says the same thing on this pasuk, which is nice and consistent of him. But here I brought two other sources that we haven't seen before. In source number 10, the Rabbeinu Yona adds, ve'et tznuim chachma, hatsina miniyat ha'adam midivrei kalon univelut. When someone acts bitsina, whatever that means, a person is basically prevented from all these bad things. Umiyot hazvarim mimidat hatsnuim. And tsnuim are people who don't speak so much. Miyot hazvarim. They speak less. V'hatsniyot goremet chachma leva'alaha. And because they speak so little, right? Siag l'chachma shtika. Right? The fence to wisdom is silence. And that's basically what the Rabbeinu Yonah is talking about here. When someone is bitsina, when someone doesn't speak so much, then they become wiser because they're listening and they're learning from everyone around them. Right, the midah, the character trait of wise people through which they achieve chachma is to be tsanua, because then if they're not speaking so much, then they're paying attention to other people. They don't have this desire to let everyone know what's on their heart. Now he quotes another pasuk. So we see here that according to the Rabbeinu Yonah, it's a little different than we've seen before. It means not speaking so much, right? Kind of like quiet. Let's just add quiet. And the Malbim finally adds the final dimension of what we're going to learn tonight. Hatsanua Shema, in source number 11, Hatsanua Shemastir Panav Me'alot B'ma'alot V'yodea Mach Archo. Hatsanua person, according to the Malbim, is someone who hides his face from rising up, let's say the social climber, right? From rising up the ladder. V'yodea mach archo, and knows his value. So he doesn't have this desire to just get higher and higher and higher on the rungs of society. He knows who he is. He's not denying himself. He's not placing himself on the bottom rung because he's not actually, you know, acknowledging his worth. But he doesn't feel the need to keep climbing higher and higher. Okay, so we'll just add knows self-worth and not a social climber. Okay, now you'll see why I'm taking the time to write this all together. I'm sorry that it's not so huge, but what I wanted to ask you is, if we put all this together, what does tzniut mean? How could you put it all together? It's a lot. But how can we put it together? I guess you guys can all see me, so I'll just go like this. Right, but how can we put it all together? What does tzniut mean according to these parshanim?
It's not external, it's internal.
Ah, okay. What do you mean by that? Expound upon that a little bit.
Well, it's how you feel, how you project yourself.
Okay.
It's not, you know, like the on page 3. It's not your shoes or
okay,
your hair.
We'll get there. We'll get there. Good.
It's how you feel on the inside and okay. How you project yourself.
Okay, good. So it's internal, not external. Good. Anything else? Okay, tell me if you disagree, okay? This is something that I did do in class, and we did have a whole discussion, but okay, it's late at night. I think it's about recognizing who we are and not needing everyone else to know it. What do you guys think? Mm-hmm. Knowing who we are and being content with that on the inside and not needing to be flashy and flaunting it for the world to see. It's almost like this, you know, we need to know our self-worth, right? I think that the Malbim at the end, the Odea Mach Archo, right? We always talk about Moshe Rabbeinu, so Anav, what does Anav really mean? It didn't mean that Moshe Rabbeinu thought he was like the lowest level of B'nai Israel society. He knew he was their leader, and he knew that he was worthy of being their leader. It's just that he didn't flaunt it. He wasn't arrogant. He took opinions from other people. He didn't think that, you know, he didn't get power hungry. He didn't get, he didn't let anything go to his head. Right? Anava, which is similar, right? Because modesty, humility, very similar. In fact, I think that humility is something that we see a lot here. Doesn't speak so much, doesn't feel the need to do anything with, you know, does the same thing inside and outside. Right? This is really knowing who we are without needing to to flaunt it. And what they found fascinating is that if you look at what the Parshanim are dealing with, all the different examples, they give us examples of how we have to act this way when we're talking about Ben Adam La'atzmo. Right, Ben Adam La'atzmo is our own character traits. For example, right, humility, knowing our own true worth. But we also have examples from Ben Adam La'chaveru, how we're supposed to act with others. In other words, limiting our speech. Right, but then there's also Ben Adam La'makom, worshiping him even when no one knows. Right, worshiping him, bitzinah, being open to his will as opposed to, you know, thinking that our will is most important. And I thought that was so interesting that they really viewed tzniut as all-encompassing. It's encompassing our entire lives. It's something that really should be a character trait that is kind of embodied within us and really that encapsulates all that we do in it and the way that we think. So based on our understanding of tzniut, does the obligation to act with tzniut apply to women only? Does it apply to men and women? Does it apply to men only?
Both.
Very good. But there's nothing in Tanakh that makes it seem like it's a women's mitzvah. It's not, right? Acting b'tzniut is hatznei alecha im alokeches for everybody. When Shlomo said tznuim, he didn't say tznuot, right? He said tznuim, that's plural for everybody. Every single member of B'nai Yisrael has an obligation to live a life of tznuot, to act b'tzniut. And I think that it's important to keep in mind because so often, you know, tzniut is viewed as something that's only incumbent upon the women and only something that we have to worry about. And while that's true that we have more, and I'm not going to deny that, and even if I wanted to, I couldn't, okay? But I think that at its core, it's important to realize that the concept of tzniut, the midah of tzniut, it applies to everybody equally. There's no gender age discrimination here. It applies to everybody. Now, what I want you to do, for those of you who have the second sheet, I really apologize that it was like that, but if you have the second booklet, if you can turn to the top, I made my students rate these from 1 to 10. I'm not going to ask you to do that. We don't have time. But what I would like you to do is look at the 10 items over here at the top. And I want you to answer, choose the top three that you believe are most representative of the essence of who you are. But if you had to choose three of these 10 items, and again, I'm not going to ask you to rate those three. I'm sorry, anyone, it looks like this page, the second booklet. I hope you have it, but if not, then share. You don't have to mark it down if you are sharing, just, you know, to think about. What do you think is most representative of who you are? If you were thinking about your own essence and who you really are, what are the top three items on this list that you would choose? And if you need four, okay, I'm not going to ask you guys to list them out. We don't have time for that. If it was a classroom discussion, then we would, but it's not. So this I will ask you. As you're choosing and discussing what represents the essence of who you are, did you find that you chose mostly external characteristics or mostly internal characteristics? Okay, it's right. Okay, good. But you're not going to do it in public, obviously, because everyone's going to think that, like, oh my gosh, you really care about your nails that much, right? Okay. I don't even notice nails, hence mine are never done. That's not because I'm not shallow, just because I don't know those details. But yes, I think that most human beings who are not shallow, but I think even most human beings who really think and who really value themselves and know their self-worth, most human beings choose internal attributes of themselves as the most representative of who they are, right? We do care about how we look. I don't think any woman, some women will deny that. But most women do care about how they look, and I think most men care about how they look. And there's a concept in Judaism, by the way, of appearing nice, like a Ben or a Bat Torah. It's not something that we don't value either. But I don't know that many people here chose, you know, my clothing, my body, and my shoes as the things that are most representative of who they are. And I think that that's important because Judaism values that too. As you said before, right, tzniut is about the internals, not about the externals. And in fact, this is the subject matter of a very often quoted pasuk when it comes to tzniut. If you turn to source number 12, right at the bottom, it's on either booklet. So if you have the other booklet, it's on page 3. On this booklet, it's also on page 3, but it's really the first page. In Tehillim Perek Mem Hei pasuk Yedalid, David HaMelech tells us, Kol kvuda bat melech pnima, that the entire honor of a princess is within. There are many different ways to interpret this pasuk. The way that I like to interpret this pasuk is that the honor of a princess is within, meaning it's in her internals, it's within herself. That we don't believe that the honor of a princess is in her crown, or in her gowns, or in her jewels. or even in her high-heel stilettos, right? We really believe that the honor of a princess is who she is inside. David HaMelech, according to many, 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 almost all of the Parsha name, or even just everyone, right? The Bat Melech in question here is all of us, right? A song comes to mind that they sing at Ari Crown for the girls. I forgot the words now, but like, I'm a princess, you know what, whatever. Anyway, it's talking about how I'm a princess of Hashem. Okay, very nice. That her father's the king. But, you know, I think that that's something that most of us will agree on, right? That the most important aspects of ourselves are the internals, and that's potentially what David HaMelech is saying here. Like I said, it's not the only way to interpret the pasuk. It's my favorite way of interpreting the pasuk, and I think it's very true. That the entire honor of a princess is within herself. The question becomes, in a physical world, where we as human beings are primed to notice the externals, how do we get people to focus on who we are? How do we get people to focus on the internals? If you chose the three things as, you know, either your feelings or your personality or your intellect or your likes and your dislikes, right? How do we get people to focus on that and not on the things that they see first? Because we live in a physical world, and our physical body is what is seen first by every single human being on the planet. And so the question is, how do we get people to go past that? How do we get people to see us for who we are and not for what we look like? And I think that the dilemma is a real one. And I think that the only way to really solve that dilemma is to try to figure out how to highlight our internals, how to make it more obvious and kind of de-emphasize the externals and highlight the internals so that people can appreciate us for who we are and what we have to offer. Right? Not in terms of physical pleasure, but in terms of everything else that's important in the world. Excuse me. And this is, I believe, how the idea of tzniut connects to clothing. Right? I said that the title was, it's not all in what we wear. I didn't say it has nothing to do with what we wear. Right? Obviously, tzniut is connected to clothing. I think most people in the room knew that. But tzniut is not only about clothing. And I don't think that it's even primarily about clothing. I think that clothing is kind of ancillary to the point. The point is to get people to highlight, to focus on our internals so that we can focus on our internals, because everything that we said here, like you said, is internal, right? It's walking bitsina with Hashem. It's recognizing who we are, but not needing to flaunt it. On the other hand, having people recognize us for who we are and not be distracted by everything else that can be in the way. And so, like I said before, this is how tzniut does actually relate to clothing, because we can utilize our clothing to help us attain that goal. Right, even though the clothing might serve as a distraction, on the other hand, we can kind of use our clothing so that it doesn't serve as a distraction, so that our internals really are focused on and revealed to the outside world. Now, just to go into clothing for a little bit, when is clothing first introduced to mankind? Very good, after the sin. Right, if you turn to source number 13, Bereshit Perek Bet Pasuk Chafei. Before the sin, the description of Adam and Chava in Gan Eden, Ve'yihiyu Shneim Arumim. And Adam and Chava were not clothed. They were naked. And you know what? They didn't care. There was no shame. It didn't matter to them. Why? How could two human beings, who were husband and wife, mind you, not even notice, not be ashamed of their nakedness? I'm sorry that I don't have sources for this piece. This is more of an idea piece. I could probably find the sources for you if you want it. I just, like, this has like become such a like clear thought in my mind that I didn't provide the sources. But if you want them, I can find them for you. But the idea is, a very famous idea, you know what, it's like in Waters of Eden, for sure, by Rav Arya Kaplan. So that's one source. And he talks about the fact that in Gan Eden, we were very different people, right? Before the sin, Adam and Chava were a different form of human being. And one of the major differences before the sin was that the externals did not take away from the internals. They were not distracted by the physical. Everything that they saw was so obviously part of one whole. It was so harmonious and so wholesome that the physical body just reflected the internals as opposed to the opposite. One proof, by the way, for this idea is that Gan Eden is described as one of the most beautiful places in the entire world. Like paradise, it was lush, and it had, you know, you picture like Hawaii or like those pictures of paradise on those advertisements. Like, they're all based, why is it called paradise? Right? Gan Eden was paradise, that's how they translate paradise. The idea, and there was water running through it, and it was lush, and it was beautiful. And why, right? What was the purpose of Gan Eden for real? Why did Hashem even put Adam and Chava in Gan Eden? To become close to Him, to have a relationship with God. So the question becomes, if the purpose of Ganeden was to have a relationship with Hashem and it was supposed to be completely spiritual, why is it described in such physical terms? Why did it have such physical beauty? Why did it need physical beauty? But the idea is that in Gan Eden, the physical represented, the external represented the internal. There was no fake. There was no, like, oh, I see one thing. Yeah, you see one, then you get the other. Everything was, it is as you saw it. Kind of like the idea of why are the Imahut described as beautiful, because it was a reflection of their spiritual, like their great spirituality. It's not that they weren't beautiful. They were. It's just that it was such a deep reflection of who they were. So in Gan Eden, the externals were just a reflection of the internals, not a distraction therefrom. And so, Vishneim Arumim V'lo Yivosheshu, not a big deal. They were naked, but it didn't matter. Because when they looked at each other's naked bodies, they saw the whole person. But what happened? Like you said, it was the sin. Right? Then they sank. In source number 14 in Bereishit Perek Gimel, we're told about the sin itself, V'teira ha'isha kitov ha'etz tama'achal. And Rebbe Tzimtashi Neuberger points out that the sin was prompted by the sense of sight. Yes, it was prompted by the speech of the Nachash, but from the speech of the Nachash to the actual sin, in between those two things, something snapped within Chava. Her perspective changed. She suddenly saw the tree differently. Before, it was forbidden. Now, suddenly, it looked good. It looked enticing, right? She saw that the tree was good to eat, and that it was desirous to the eyes, and it was, you know, pleasant to... We don't really know what that means, but something about the intellect to, you know, I guess like internalize intellectually. So she takes from the fruit and she eats it. And she gives it to Adam and he eats it too. And suddenly, because her sight had suddenly changed, what happened? Her sight changed, right? The immediate repercussions of the sins was a change in their vision. Suddenly, they were very aware of their physical bodies. Something, one of the major things that changed between the pre-chait Adam and Chava and the post-chait Adam and Chava was the way that the externals and the internals related to each other. In Gan Eden, the externals were really a reflection of the internals. Once they sinned, suddenly there was a disconnect. And the externals served to distract them from the internals, and suddenly they noticed that they were naked. Suddenly, their naked bodies became something that they noticed in a way that they hadn't before. So what do they do in the absence of anything else? They just grab some fig leaves and put it on them because they didn't really have anything else to do to cover up their nakedness. But then comes Hashem and saves the day in Pasuk Chafalev, way after he delivers their punishment. I actually think it might be the last Pasuk in Perek Gimel. Vayas Hashem Elokim la'adam u'le'ishto katnot or v'yal bishim. Hashem provides Adam and Chava with leather garments and he dresses them. And this is the first instance that clothing is ever used in the history of mankind. Hashem provides the clothing for Adam and Chava. It seems that Hashem wanted them to have this clothing. Right? This is something that Hashem not only, you know, approved of, but provided for them. Because when the externals serve to distract us from the internals, we kind of need to cover up those externals so that they no longer serve as that same distraction. Now, I think that it's interesting to note, based on this, you know, just like the origin of clothing in the first place, the purpose of clothing, the reason why Hashem gave Adam and Chava clothing was to cover themselves up, right? When we use clothing to attract others' attention, right? When we use clothing to kind of provoke other people to have certain thoughts, you know, are we really fulfilling the purpose of that clothing? If Hashem gave us clothing to cover ourselves up, then using that clothing to kind of play peekaboo with our bodies and to kind of, you know, reveal our bodies while kind of covering up a little bit, it doesn't really seem to be in line with the original purpose of clothing in the first place. Clothing was introduced to mankind to help us focus on the internals so that we would cover up the distracting externals so that we can really focus on who the person is on the inside. And again, going back to the beginning, the top of page 3, I think we would all want to be noticed for our internals because that's who we really think we are. And so the purpose of clothing, and we're going to see the purpose of tzniut in the, really as a whole, is to refocus people that we meet, people that we know, people that we love, to really focus them on who we are as a person and not what we look like on the outside. Just, you know, to follow up with Hashem's original intent. Now, there are some interesting articles that I found on, you know, the meaning of clothing and how clothing affects us that I'd like to, you know, just read some excerpts. So this is going to be, if you have this second booklet, if you turn the page, I found it fascinating that there's a lot to be said about clothing and how it affects us. In fact, I wasn't able to get it because it wasn't in the library, but there's a whole book written on why women wear what they wear. Did you guys hear about this book? Is it like someone told me to read it, and I tried. I couldn't. There's a whole book dedicated to why we wear what we wear. In fact, when I was looking for pictures on Google Images for the source sheet, I found a bunch of quotes and pictures that say, you know, when a woman says, "I have nothing to wear," with like a picture of this full closet of clothing, right? It doesn't mean she has nothing to wear. It means that she has nothing to reflect what she's feeling today, right? We really, really do use our clothing to project to others how we're feeling, right? Like the schlumpy look means like, oh, she's not feeling so great, or, you know, she's not going to work today, or whatever it is, right? The more dressed up look, at least in my case, is like, oh, she must be going to see 16-year-olds because they actually care what she wears. You know, every woman is different, but we all do use clothing to project a certain image of ourselves, which is interesting because on the one hand, we use clothing to kind of cover up our externals and have people focus on our internals, and we see that, like, we actually want people to know how we feel internally by choosing what to wear externally. And this is not something that we just, like, know intuitively as women who look in our closet and say we have nothing to wear, but there's actually this article called What Your Clothes Might Be Saying About You. I found it fascinating. First impressions are often more significant than you might think. Look at the first line. She's not my type. He couldn't hack it. She looks friendly. He looks efficient. I can tell she's an extrovert. What do you mean you can tell she's an extrovert? What do you mean? Before you even see them interacting with people, right? We make snap judgments about people from the clothes they wear. That's a statement. That's a psychological fact, apparently. On what basis? There's much more to our clothing choices than we might imagine. For many people, what they wear is merely a matter of habit. But when we dress in the morning, it might pay us to be a little more careful in the choices we make. Doing something different with your clothes might be a way of changing the impression others have of you. So she goes on to quote a few studies in the UK. The first study is about how they took, you know, a few different pictures. Some men were wearing, you know, tailored suits, like made to fit them, tailor made, and others, they're called bespoke, I think, in British language, bespoke suits. And then there were other off the peg bought on the high street, which I think is just like Central Avenue, Main Street, whatever. Like, you know, you just buy it in the store. And that in literally 5 seconds of looking at the pictures, the people who were looking at the pictures, both men and women, judged the men in the tailor made suits to be, they judge them more favorably in personality than they did the guy who was in a suit that was just taking off the peg in the store. They rated him, if you turn to the second to last paragraph on the bottom, they rated him as more confident, successful, flexible, and a higher earner in a tailor-made suit than when he wore a high street, meaning Main Street equivalent. Since the model's face in the pictures was blanked out, these impressions must have been formed after quickly eyeing what he was wearing, because they couldn't look at his expression or the seriousness in his eyes. So our clothes say a great deal about who we are and can signal a great deal of socially important things to others, even if the impression is actually unfounded. Research suggests that these impressions about us can start in childhood. One study found that teachers made assumptions about children's academic ability based on their clothing. We don't do that here, but, you know. Right. So in a second study that they did with women, and this one relates a little bit more to Sneed specifically, look at the second paragraph. We made minor manipulations to female office clothing to see how this affected first impressions of them. We also researched whether the occupational role of the woman made any difference to these impressions. We tested this with 129 female participants who rated images of faceless by pixelation female models on 6 competence-based dimensions: intelligence, confidence, trustworthiness, responsibility, authority, and organization. In all cases, the clothing was conservative. Okay, so we're not talking about, you know, provocative clothing here. It was all conservative, but varied slightly by skirt length and an extra button being fastened or unfastened on a blouse, which I thought was really fascinating. The models were described as having different occupational roles varying by status: high senior manager or low receptionist. The images were only presented for a maximum of 5 seconds. The assessment of the competencies we measured, which should surely not be affected by these minor clothing manipulations. Surely people use proper evidence to make such judgments. I'm afraid we found that the clothing did matter. People rated the senior manager less favorably when her dress style was more, quote, provocative. But remember, it wasn't provocative. It was just one less button fastened and slightly, maybe like an inch above the hemline of the other one. And, right, sorry, she related to him more, She related more less favorably when her dress style was more provocative and more favorably when dressed more conservatively, longer skirt, buttons-up blouse. I reiterate that the clothing in the provocative condition was still very conservative in style and look. It was not a short skirt and a revealing blouse, but a skirt slightly above the knee, and one button on the blouse undone. The rating of the receptionist, interestingly, role was not affected by these clothing manipulations, suggesting that there may be more leeway for some jobs than others. So, even subtle changes to clothing style can contribute to our negative impressions of the confidence of women who hold higher status positions. Wear or beware. I just thought that was very interesting. Just the idea that what we wear affects others' impressions of us, affects the way that other people relate to us, the assumptions they make about us, especially first impressions. And then the next article, which I'm not going to read as much, makes up this term, next page, called enclothed cognition, which is the idea that clothing affects how we feel, that we were talking about a little bit before. And they basically did these studies where they had people put on a white coat. Some people they told the white coat was a painter's coat, and other people they told the white coat was a doctor's coat. It was the same exact coat. And they had them do some problems that required higher order thinking skills. And the people wearing what they thought was a painter's coat actually performed not as well as the people who were told they were wearing a doctor's coat. Even though they were the same people, even though it was the same coat, but when they felt that they were dressed in a certain way, they performed better, which is fascinating. That the clothing not only affects how others think of ourselves, but even of us, but it affects how we think of ourselves. And so you can see the picture on page 7 of the guy putting on the coat that really seemed pretty nondescript. And, in page 8 on the bottom, it says, putting on your power. So how can we use the enclosed cognition, the bold page 8, putting on your power, how can we use the enclosed cognition findings to our benefit? What kind of symbolic meaning does each article of clothing in your closet hold for you? Do your loafers remind you of a logical, erudite lawyer? Do your 4-inch high heels make you think of a confident woman walking down Wall Street? Does your leather bomber jacket make you think of a rebel? Perhaps you can choose to make the monotonous daily task of getting dressed more fun and work to your advantage. Try mindfully incorporating the findings. Okay, so they're talking about fashion here. But I think that it's fascinating that the idea that clothing is important, which stems, it definitely is there in Judaism. It's something that the general world has acknowledged as well as being really important and really impactful on who we are. The last thing I would like to focus on, I don't have it here, is back to the first source sheet. I apologize. And this I really found fascinating. I want to thank Shelley Stopak, your sister-in-law, for showing me this article in the Tribune. This is photocopied from the Washington Post, but it actually appeared in the Tribune. I don't know who plagiarized who. But it appeared in the Tribune here, November 18th, 2008. The first photocopy, I think, is from the Post. That's weird. The first photocopy is from the Tribune, and the second photocopy is from the Post. I don't know how that happened. But if you look at the pictures, wanted, designers who respect women. Okay, so if you notice, they're pretty sneezily dressed, which I thought was interesting. But go to the article. The article says some very interesting things about the recent kind of coup in the fashion world. A single brand captivated the fashion industry during the spring 2019 runway shows. The frustrated and angry argument was ostensibly about clothes, but in truth, it was sparked by the same triggers that have consumed the broader culture. On the surface, the story of Celine centered on the brand's transformation under a new male designer from sophisticated, thoughtful restraint to, I don't even know how to pronounce the words, I'm sorry, ostentation. But dig for a bit and you see, so basically there was a female designer who stepped down and she was, she made the brand into, the face of sophistication, thoughtful restraint, and the male took over, suddenly it was like crazy ostentatious. But dig for a bit and you see the fashion world debating women's power and agency versus that of the men who would define them. By the time the shows came to a close, most every collection had been viewed with a few key questions in mind. Are these clothes in service to women? Do these frocks make sense in the life of a woman? Not a girl, not an adolescent, but a woman with responsibilities and daily demands. Listen to this line, and with this I'll end. Do these clothes elevate her, or do they threaten to make her look foolish? This is in the Chicago Tribune on November 18th, 2018. Do these clothes elevate her? And I would like to end with that thought because I think that it's so important to realize that this isn't even just a Jewish concept, right? The idea that our clothing should not reduce us or, to objects. And this is the whole, you know, there's a lot of debate going on here with sexual objectification and everything like that. I just read a really fascinating book that I couldn't show anyone in my house what the title was, because the title is Girls and Sex. And it's all about, like, high school, adolescent girls in high school and college, and basically, like, the sexual culture and the culture of objectification. And it was so interesting, because these girls who are on college campuses want to empower themselves, and they're, you know, everything's open to them, and they should get the same salaries as the men and their counterparts in the CEO positions, etc. And yeah, what are they doing on Friday nights? They're dressing up in Chicago weather in the winter in their mini skirts and stiletto heels, and they're getting drunk and they're letting guys take advantage of them. And then on Monday they're going back to class and trying to be the empowered woman. And it spoke about that paradox and how, you know, if you're gonna objectify yourself, what, you know, it's a very, very interesting culture going on in the world in general. But I just thought that question published in a regular newspaper, of just posing, does the clothing elevate us, or does it make us look foolish? Right? Does it bring us down to the level of, you know, our physical bodies, or do we use our clothing to elevate us, to have people focus on our internals, so that we can feel valued for who we are and not what we look like? So that's all we're going to discuss tonight about, you know, it's not all in what we wear. Of course, it has to do with what we wear, but I hope that it's clear that it's not all in what we wear. It's really about what's on the inside. And what we wear is really just secondary. It's to help us, to help others and ourselves focus on what's the inside. So thank you so much for coming. I'm looking forward to seeing hopefully many of you next week at Rebecca Amster's. Thank you.